Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
A week ago, when Bengaluru FC embarked on their journey to North Korea, not many knew what to expect. So one man decided to travel all the way to Pyongyang with them. So did he find an answer to all his questions? Well, let's just find out. Hello guys, and welcome to a brand new episode of Injury Time, a football podcast that takes a closer look at the beautiful game in India. Well, it's been quite a week for Indian football. Bengaluru FC were in North Korea for the AFC Cup game, and the Under-17 World Cup, which is just a few weeks away, is running into trouble. Well, all of that and more on this episode, and I've been joined by two special guests. One chap who's covered the length and breadth of Korea, both North and South, Mihir. Hello, Mihir.
Hi, Naveen. What's up?
Yeah, you're back from North Korea this time round.
Yeah, what an unbelievable trip for all of us.
Exactly. We'll get to that pretty soon. And our other guest, the guy who's known for the Twitter handle he runs, one-stop shop for all your Indian football needs. Yes, guys, I'm talking about Football News India and the man behind him, Uni. Hello, Uni.
Hello, Naveen. Thank you for inviting me for the Injury Time podcast.
It's a great pleasure to having you here. Guys, so without wasting much of our time, let's get cracking. First of all, we go straight to North Korea and the news from North Korea. And our correspondent from North Korea, Mihir. How was it? Like, should I be calling it North Korea or should I be calling it DPR Korea? What should it be?
Well, we are in India, so we can call whatever the hell we want. We can call it the land of the rocket man for all we care.
Well, that's how it's panning out to be.
Yeah. But the locals there prefer that we call it DPR Korea or DPRK.
Uh-huh.
The moment you mention North Korea, they'll just stop you there, and that's the only time they're rude.
Uh-huh.
Because the locals are pretty polite wherever we talk to them. But to say it was an unbelievable experience for all of us, not just for me, even for the players, you know, when you talk to them, I think that would be a very, very big understatement. I mean, from the time we landed there, you know, when we took the flight from Beijing to Pyongyang, I mean, we all tried to keep a very open mind. But the moment we land there, I mean, we get to know that, you know, the things they talk about North Korea are actually what they are. I mean, at the immigration line, there's this lady who just comes to me, and I think it was Anthony Dovale next to me, and Eric. So she just comes, walks up to the three of us, and she puts out her hand and just tells us to submit our passports and mobile phones. And she takes that and she just disappears into a room.
And pretty strange, I see.
Yeah, and then there's this big giant guy with a very, very serious face. He comes, he hands over a form to us, which is basically an immigration form, but it's a very detailed immigration form where we have to write whatever is there in the bag. And below that is a disclaimer, which basically says that any false declaration will lead to a punishment according to North Korean laws. Now they don't say what the laws are, so it's left pretty vague. So we don't know if it'll be just a slap on our face or 15 years of hard labor. So we are all kind of freaked out there already. And we land at 4 o'clock, and till 7 o'clock we are just at the airport, getting our bags screened, getting our mobile phones, laptops, camera, everything screened. And thankfully, 14 bags haven't arrived. Okay. I say thankfully because if those 14 bags would have arrived, perhaps we would have stayed the entire night at the airport.
But I think that's one reason why not many flights land in North Korea, isn't it?
Yeah, just 3 flights per day. I mean it's pretty crazy.
So well, yeah. Mia,
no, Unni was saying something.
No, I was just remarked that that's it. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so finally, you know, we are at the airport, we have done our immigration, we are waiting for some information on the missing bags, and half of the team, like including Sunil and the foreign players, all the Spanish players, and all other players. I mean, even Gurpreet's bag wasn't there. Most of the players didn't get their bags, and we are waiting for some information, right? And we are waiting there. Suddenly, it's around 6:30, and the entire airport goes dark. And I mean, it's not an electricity cut. It's just that the shift of all the guys who are working at the airport is over, and the last flight has landed. The last flight is out of the country, and there's no work for them over there. So they just switch off the entire airport. The entire airport is dark. There's just one man in the military uniform watching a TV which has Kim Jong-un on it, and there is revolutionary music playing. And next to us in the arrivals hall is this photo collage of missiles being launched and missiles being paraded across the city. And we are 26 of us trying to figure out where we have landed and what do we do. We reach the hotel, and finally all formalities are over by 9 o'clock in the night. We go to our rooms. I mean, imagine the stress the players have been under, because I think they had a flight from Bangalore to Bombay on Sunday at 8 p.m. So they all would have, I guess, left around 5:30 in the evening, and till Monday night 9 o'clock they haven't rested.
Absolutely.
I mean, finally Monday is over. It's a new morning. Tuesday, I mean, there is still no news of the missing baggage. So the players and a few other guys from the co manage, I mean the support staff, they managed to go to a sports showroom just near our hotel, and it's unbelievable that a pair of shoes that will cost us $60 in India is being sold at $175
My
over there,
God.
and they have no other option but to buy those. So they end up buying six pair of shoes for around $900 or something like that.
Yes.
And I checked with the players about the quality, and it's just one time wear.
That's like
Then
$900 down the drain.
$900 for one training session. Still, I mean, obviously they have to prepare. They try to focus, and just a couple of hours before the training session, they realize they don't have balls to practice, because all the balls are in the bags which are lying somewhere in the airport. So the manager of the team requests the 4.25 staff to arrange for some balls, and they initially say that they can't arrange anything, and no one knows whether they'll be able to practice or not. So it's match day minus one, and the players are not just thinking about, you know, the match, which they need to ensure that they don't lose by 3 goals or so, but they're also thinking about their missing baggage. They're thinking about their shoes. They're thinking about the footballs. They're thinking about North Korea. They're thinking about the restrictions that are on them. They're thinking about the missiles. They're thinking about the food that is being served to them in the hotel. And it's just, I mean, I was stressed out just thinking and just imagining how can they really perform the next day. Somehow the 4.25 guys, you know, they managed to get 4 balls. So the 20 players share 4 balls between them, and they have a decent kick about in the stadium. The stadium itself is incredible. I mean, we talk about all the negative things about North Korea, but I guess we all can learn a thing or two about, you know, having a good stadium there. It's an incredible facility. I mean, forget the fact that it's 150,000 seater, but the way it's maintained, the surface is pathetic. We'll come to that later when we talk about the match. But the way they just handled the whole thing, you know, I mean, 4.25 is a small club compared to what we see generally in Asia or even in India. But they apparently, according to one of the team guys, they have 20 teams right from under 8 to the senior teams.
Oh.
And they have 10 playing their 10 playing fields.
Okay.
Within the stadium itself, there are 4 practice grounds,
okay,
and it's just incredible, the
pretty
facility.
Well-planned facility, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Mihir, you spoke about the stress that players and you who was in Pyongyang are going through during this period. But back home in India also, only coming to you, we knew there would be no telecast. We knew getting news out of Pyongyang would be difficult. And Twitter just went crazy, isn't it? How did this Twitter react?
It was pretty interesting. So that day when I got up, the first thing I did was like check about the internet connectivity in North Korea to see whether there is any possibility. So it almost became apparent to me that there is isn't going to be a telecast because I saw the kind of conditions, restrictions internet has and things like that. And during the match, I mean, a lot of Bangalore FC fans were around. They were like looking for updates. And then a couple of updates come through from the Bangalore FC handle. And they were like, okay. And there were some other people too engaging on Twitter. And it looks like a couple of them were bookies who were just looking around for some information. And yeah, I didn't. So I don't want to engage them, but so Bangalore FC put out one tweet, and one of them just called out that, telling that, look, the update is from Bangalore. So then after that, BFC put out a tweet telling that, okay, we have to send updates from Bangalore, not from there, because there is a blackout over there. And I was simultaneously trying to find out information from the AFC Match Center. So they had a ticker going on, and since there were no goals, it pretty much was perfect because I could manage the time. And some of these people on Twitter was pretty damn sure that even AFC can't get results out from North Korea. They were like, they are
Oh,
just
okay.
perfect. They
Well, they would have thought AFC is bluffing for all you know.
in the competition, probably they have an access. I mean, some separate access, but I think that also did not work out. Anyway, we couldn't ratify that whether they were having any internet connection or not because no goals were scored. Then suddenly, in the first half, BFC sent one tweet, and the next tweet was came after like 15 minutes or something. So there were fans expressing concern whether the team is doing okay, what are they doing, and things like that. Yeah, it was a pretty intense situation actually.
Well, that about in India, but in Pyongyang, Mir, how did the match pan out? None of us watched it. You were one of the lucky persons, I would say, who got to witness both the team in action in Pyongyang. Could you just take us through the game?
It's a miracle how Bangalore didn't lose that match. I mean, from the first minute. I wasn't sitting in the stands. I had a camera and I was on the pitch side. I was standing behind. First half, I was standing behind the North Korean goal, and the second half, I was standing behind Gurpreet. And it was ridiculous at the pace at which 4.25 were playing. I mean, it just looked like they'd guzzled the entire fuel that's available in North Korea, and they were running up and down, up and down, up and down throughout. They are so quick. They are technically so sharp. It was unbelievable. So the problem actually, there were a couple of problems here. A, the Bangalore FC players could not adjust to the ground conditions. Now the pitch there was an artificial surface. It wasn't in a very good condition. So it was a rubber surface, and you could see the black layer beneath the surface.
Oh, okay.
So and it was extremely hard.
Right.
So the players were always taking an extra touch to control the ball, and that extra touch allowed some two North Korean players to directly, just come and cut to just mark out the player who had the ball, who had the position. So they were always hurried. They were never at peace, or they were never able to peacefully pass the ball around or really, get themselves into the match. The first half was pretty much okay. Like, both sides did not have that many good chances. But second half, I've never seen a team attack for the entire 45 minutes. Bangalore FC literally were, I mean, all 11 players were inside their 25-yard or 30-yard line. If you just draw an imaginary line there and imagine where 30 yards is.
Right.
and they are all within that limit. And apart from, I can't think of more than 1 minute in total in the second half that they spent, you know, in their half, in North Korea, in the North Korean team's half. Gurpreet pulled off some amazing saves, but it's just amazing that how it's incredible how North Korea did not score, and that's what the coach said, that's what the players said as well after the match.
Well, just incredible that the North Korean side couldn't score, and Gurpreet also pulled off a penalty save, isn't it? How did that come about?
So basically, the 4.25 had, if I recall it properly, they had 5 really good chances. One they missed almost from 2 yards out in an open goal. Gurpreet was stranded near the far post, and at the opposite end there was a striker who just had to tap the ball in, but it hit his knee and it just went agonizing. It just centimeters wide from the post, and there was no one standing in front of him, so he could have just afforded to take a extra touch and just tap it in again. So that was one very, very easy chance they missed. But there were 3 really good saves that Gurpreet made. One was a very, very good diving. He just stretched completely to his left in the air and he saved this header. From Kim Yoo-sung. I mean, it was somewhere in the 50th or 55th minute. Then second time again, they were very quick through the center. The right back, his name was Kwon Chong-hyuk. He was extremely quick, and what he basically did was he just ran through the right up and down, and he just took away the entire Bangalore FC flank for a toss. I mean, he just did not give them any time or space, and even the Bangalore FC players looked tired because of all the travel and all whatever was happening. So after 60 minutes, they were looking tired. And these guys were just running. So, York was constantly creating nuisance from the right flank. And in the center, they had their midfielder, Ri Yong-jin, who was with his strong physique and all, he was taking Tony out of equation on a number of equations. Now, Tony is technically very good, but he comes across as a very fragile player. I mean, you can easily knock him off.
Uh-huh.
A bit like what Jackie Chan perhaps is.
Oh, right.
If you take in that context. And up front, Song had many chances, but he just couldn't convert any of them. Gurpreet eventually was the saving grace. I mean, if you know, he wasn't there, then Bangalore would have lost by 3 or 4 goals, and that would have been the tie for it.
Oh, okay.
Does
this also say a thing or two about the Bengaluru defense? Because you just said if Gurpreet was not there, the team would have ended up conceding 3 or 4. What does it say about the defense?
I wouldn't just blame it on the defense, to be honest, because their midfield was completely non-existent. They really couldn't stamp any authority. Sunil was outmarked. I mean, Sunil couldn't do. You usually see Sunil, you know, at least try certain things, to at least hold up the play up front or try to do his things. But he couldn't do anything. Very frankly, 4.25 were technically much superior than Bengaluru FC.
Okay.
And if we look back, the rain in the first leg really came as a survivor. I mean, it rescued Bengaluru FC because of the weather conditions, they couldn't, 4.25 couldn't play their natural game. They're not used to playing on a natural surface as well.
Right.
So the conditions, so Bangalore actually took advantage of their home conditions, which 4.25 couldn't. And that ultimately was the decisive factor.
Absolutely. Like, I think that rain played a really decisive factor because, like Mihir, you mentioned, the wingers, even in the first half here in Bangalore, in the first leg, those wingers really created a lot of nuisance for the Bengaluru defense. But you're playing at home, and minus all the fatigue that comes along with traveling abroad, especially when you're traveling to a country like North Korea, the team looked much fitter, the team looked much fresher, they could hold up play. But I think that also worked against them when they traveled to Pyongyang, isn't it?
But it's just, you can't take one factor of the game or one part of the game and analyze it. I mean, you have to look it at as a whole, and as a whole, Bengaluru FC did not have a great game. It wasn't just the defense, or it wasn't just the midfield. I mean, apart from Gurpreet, the 10 other players had a very, very mediocre game. And the good thing is that all the players acknowledged they had a very poor game. Like, I was talking to Eric the next morning at the breakfast, and I just asked him, are you sore from last night? And he said, no, I still see 4.25 defenders running around me.
Oh, okay. There's nothing rings around him, probably.
Yeah, so that's the kind of impact those players left on Bengaluru as well. That's a good thing. I mean, so the Bengaluru players are not arrogant or overconfident with this win.
Absolutely.
They knew that they were the second best side on that day, which perhaps also makes them a bit cautious going into the match against Dushan with Tajikistan. And perhaps that can work in their favour. I mean, if they're not overconfident, they realise that they really need to work on certain things. I guess it's only a good thing over there.
Well, next they're up against the runners-up from the 2015 edition, a team that lost to Johor Darul Takzim in the final. All we can do is hope that we have an exciting encounter. First leg will be an away leg for Bengaluru FC when they travel down to Tajikistan, and the second one in Bengaluru. We'll get you more on that as and when we approach the match day. But there are news coming in from Kochi this time around, Uni, isn't it? And this is relating to the Under-17 FIFA World Cup, which is a few weeks away.
So basically, what's unfolding in Kochi is something really unfortunate. So the Kallur Stadium in Kochi houses some shops. I think there are more than 40 odd shops, which includes some cafes, some government offices, I heard. Also, there are a couple of IT companies, I heard. Then
inside the stadium complex.
Yeah, so warehouses and things like that. So FIFA at the outset was like very strict about this, that they wanted things to, I mean, these shops to close down, especially places like cafes which use inflammable materials like LPG, and there were guard-ons, I heard, for some lubricants and things like that. So so they were particular about closing down. But I think the Kochi Stadium is actually owned by an autonomous authority called GCDA, which is like an organization that has been built up for the development, I mean, conducting all kind of infrastructure development activities for Kochi. So this is, there is a lot of politics going on. They drag their feet, and I think the government's attention also was not completely into this project. So they also failed to intervene and sort this out. And then eventually when the time came, the shopkeepers went to the High Court and got a stay for the order which GCDA had produced for them to close down the shops starting from September 15th. And the matter went to the court, and the court asked, who's going to pay, these people the damages if they have to close down, and why? And they also accused the government, not accused, I mean, they also told that the government did not take an active interest in, sorting out the issue. So right now, what I heard is there was a last hearing which is supposed to happen today. And the court was supposed to, mandate a certain amount of money that this particular organization called GCDA will, they will acquire that fund and they will provide it as compensation for these people, is what last I heard and read about it. But there has not been a decision on how much that fund should be. So right now, what this has cost us, because of these issues, the stadium was supposed to hand over to FIFA on 15th, but that did not happen. Then it got shifted to 18th, that is today, I mean yesterday, but that also did not happen. And I heard that they are waiting for the court, which apparently is going to come out with some kind of settlement tomorrow, that is on Tuesday. And once that comes out, they will decide on a further date where they can actually transfer the stadium to the to the LOC. So that's pretty much what is happening over there. It's a mess. I mean, I think it's an organizational mess. Nobody attended to it. And if you look at it from the shopkeepers' perspective, they are correct too, because you can't just go and tell somebody to just stop working all of a sudden. So I mean, they should have charted out a process or whatever behind it, and they did not get that done, and it was in a complete mess now. But eventually, I feel the government will step in and sort this out, because at the last minute, if the World Cup is going to go from there to some other place, it's going to be a big disaster for the government as well. So I think they will take some interest and get some something sorted out.
But only there are like two things here, right? I mean, there has always been this conspiracy theory floating around that at some level the central government wants Ahmedabad to be one of the venues, and Kochi obviously was an easy target to be dropped because of the problems over there. Mm-hmm. And there is also this other thing where Avia Chepi has said that you don't mind going ahead with five venues. That's what Hemir Yarzad also said. Now, with those two possibilities looming, do you think Kochi might be dropped as one of the venues? Is that a genuine concern in Kerala right now?
So there's a nodal officer which the Kerala government has appointed to oversee all this renovations and things like that. He is pretty confident. He is telling that he even denied that FIFA issued an ultimatum to them. So he's like, there was a scrolling piece of news going on in a Malayalam channel about this, telling that he has denied it. So, but if I think it's going to be a big disaster for the government, so they're going to try their best, I guess, to get it done there. At this moment, I mean, a lot of work has been done. I know that. There are some problems here and there is what I heard from the field, but still huge chunk of work has been done, and even FIFA is quite happy with their with the progress and all those things. So at this last moment, I don't really expect it moving out of Kochi, but if that happens, I think a lot of hearts will be broken, and a lot of football fans are going to really blame this government, the Kerala government. So I think they'll actively step in and do something about it.
I think it will kind of sum up the mess that Kerala football has been in all these years if they are stripped out of the...
So I mean, I think for the World Cup, there's a lot of factors, I think, because the local football associations probably are not getting used a lot. So I think most of them are like we don't have anything to do with this kind of an attitude. That is, from a lot of places, we have heard this from Goa. We have seen what has happened in Guwahati with the LOC.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a general gripe that, these people are who have been the custodians of football in these states have not been engaged, and a lot of work is being done directly by the LOC and things like that. So I just read a comment from the Kerala Football Association General Secretary also while I was skimming through the news for this particular stadium issue, and he has outrightly said that we are not involved in this. This is somebody else who is doing this. That is entirely upon GCDA whether they had to issue a notice for the shops to move out. It is not our area at all.
This is raising their hand, getting out of all the trouble.
So, yeah, everybody is trying to
pin the blame on others.
Well, if Kochi ends up losing the match, I don't know what will happen to that sold out Kochi, the stadium for the Spain versus Brazil game. What I hear is it's already been sold out.
Oh,
okay, you will be on your way for that game. Well, while Kochi has been in a mess and there are problems surrounding all the stadiums, all the host venues in India, but the stadiums slowly but steadily are turning out to be a really good prospects for the World Cup, isn't it? Looking beautiful, the renovated ones.
Yeah, Actually, I think the challenge now would be to think what will happen to these stadiums and the other infrastructure after the World Cup. I think there will have to be an active follow-up from the state associations or at least from the AIFF to keep these things in order, because I'm seriously concerned about the training grounds, even though the FIFA LOC is claiming that this is going to be legacy and a lot of people are going to get
well, legacy in India has never been good,
but I seriously doubt it. Whether these local authorities who are owners of these things is going to maintain these. At least the stadiums, I hope, because regular football matches now with two leagues and things like that, some kind of maintenance might go on. But we'll have to see what will happen to these training pitches, because they have invested quite a bit in those as well. If you see, they have you know, installed floodlights, good turf and all those things. So pretty much good amount of money has been spent over there as well. So the real challenge will be to know what will happen to these after the World Cup.
Absolutely right. Mir, especially when you talk about the legacy program for this stadiums, and you take Delhi as an example, while the Jawaharlal Nehru Stadium will be engaged in other sporting activities, what about the other pitches, the training grounds? Do you have enough football and tournaments and activity in Delhi to keep these grounds engaged?
Not really, but see, Delhi, the local football structure is kind of dead. I've been here for the last 2 years and I haven't really seen a very, very active local football league. Gradually, there are clubs coming up and they're trying to show some seriousness. But if I'm not wrong, one of the senior office bearers of the Delhi Football Association is kind of facing sexual harassment charges right now. So it's pretty messed up there. But at the same time, one good thing that I've noticed in Delhi is, because everything comes under the state the central government, under the Sports Authority of India, they keep all these stadiums open for normal public. So, for example, right now I use the stadiums that we built for the CWG to play tennis and badminton for 60 rupees for 1 hour.
Well, and you're talking to a fit guy here.
Yeah, look at me and you'll have an idea how fit I am.
Tennis and badminton says that.
Yeah, I mean, I said I play, but I never said I play well. I just stand there and I do something. But I'm guessing that, you know, I hope they do something similar with the football fields, because right now, if you want to play a five-a-side football match, there aren't many places in Delhi. Whereas in Bombay or even in Bangalore, I guess, there are plenty
Absolutely.
Of curves mushrooming all over the malls and multiplexes and
right.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Delhi, you have to go to some godforsaken place in South Delhi where, you know, I mean, the chances of you getting mugged are more rather than nutmegging someone. So I hope they use these facilities for these things and kind of create a football culture in Delhi, which neither the I-League or ISL has managed to do.
Well, nutmeg or not, one thing is for certain, that Delhi will have some footballing action with ISL coming in, Delhi Dynamos continuing another season in the ISL. But another news that is coming in from ISL is that there is a plan being floated that the reserves team of this ISL franchises could field those teams in the lower divisions of the league. Uni, coming to you with this, a good idea to engage and keep the reserves teams also busy at the national level?
See, on the whole, it looks like a good idea. But what I feel is like right now, I think very few teams have a reserve team as of now. I mean, like if you look at KBFC, they have some players they have said that will be part of the reserves. I think Bangalore FC will have, because they've been participating in the under-18 and things like that, under-18 league and things like that. So they might have some of their boys graduating and some other players which they have signed as reserves. So it's a good plan. On the whole, when you look at it, it's a good plan, because these players who might not get a chance to play in the ISL can actually keep them fit and play some matches in second division. But it all depends on how many of these teams are going to actually have a reserve side. I still don't think a lot of them will have probably Pune FC and a couple of more of them. More of them might just have it for the season. Further going on, going forward, I guess more teams will join in, and at that time it will be a much better affair, I guess.
Uni just made a point that not many teams have reserves team as of today. Do you think this idea floated by the AIFF is a way to ensure that there are enough teams participating in the lower divisions?
So basically, AIFF really needs to sort its house out. I mean, they come across right now as pretty clueless as to what's happening, what shape the Indian domestic structure will take. I mean, they've been coming up with new plans almost every week, whether it's fielding the under-17 team in the I-League, sending them to China, sending them to Portugal. Then they come up with this plan of ISL teams, you know, sending their reserve teams. The fact is that we are kind of overcomplicating the whole thing over here. The basic thing is whether you have good teams or you don't. Right now, whether it's the ISL or I-League, if one team is short of two players because of injuries, they don't have enough replacements. So the entire talk of having an entire reserve team is pretty much, it doesn't make sense to me because it's going to lack quality. Alright, I mean, I get one point that, you know, some players might get some playing time and all. But again, if you look at the overall picture, it's just a matter of filling numbers. It's just a matter of making numbers and ensuring they have a minimum quota of teams to conduct the league. So someone at the AFF really needs to put their foot down and say that this is our plan for the league and this is how we are going to go about it. I mean, as fans and journalists, we can moan about whatever IMG Reliance is doing to Indian football. But right now, they have the higher moral ground. They can come up and say that, look, our reserve teams are playing in the I-League, which is why I-League is taking place, first of all. And that is the position that AIFF does not want to be if it wants to be seen as a very, very serious stakeholder in Indian football right now.
Absolutely. Right. Well, will AIFF do its bit or not? Well, only time will say. But right now, I am run out with my rundown. Guys, nothing more to add to this episode of Injury Time. Thanks a lot for joining me, Uni and Mihir.
Thank you, Naveen. Thank you, Uni. Nice being here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Naveen, and thank you, Mayor. It was nice talking to you guys, and once again, thank you for inviting me to the Injury Time podcast.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for joining us. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into this episode of Injury Time. Let me just remind you all, we are on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is called Injury Time IND, and you can find us on Facebook at Injury Time. Until we bring you the next episode of Injury Time, have a great week and enjoy the game.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.